The crowd had fallen back a little now, sensing that the mood of the events had changed, as Lee and the bear and the captain walked on towards the five men who stood between them and the schooner. Hester was checking all around for other figures lurking in the alleys between the warehouses, or at a window above, or across the water on the west quay, for a handy shot with a good rifle could pick them off easily. Lee was very conscious of the sound of their boots on the flagstone quay, of the ceaseless scream of seagulls, of the chugging of the steam crane across the water, and the clank and crash of the great bucket as it unloaded coal from the hold of the tanker and dumped it in the wagons. Every separate sound was bright and clear, and Lee and Hester both heard the little click at the same moment. It was the sound of a revolver being cocked, and it came from up ahead, Lee thought. But Hester's ears could pinpoint an ant on a blade of grass, and she said at once,
"Second man, Lee."
The men were standing abreast in a line about 15 yards ahead. Three of them were holding cudgels or sticks, but the other two had their hands behind their backs, and before Hester had finished saying Lee, Lee's pistol was in his hand and pointing straight at the second man from the left.
"You drop that gun right now. You just let go and let it fall behind you."
The man had stiffened in surprise. He probably hadn't expected Lee to move so fast, and quite possibly no one had pointed a gun at him with intent before. He was just a boy, no older than 20. His eyes widened and he swallowed nervously before dropping the pistol.
"Now kick it over here."
The boy groped behind him with the toe of his boot and sent the pistol bouncing over the flagstones. The captain bent to pick it up. Then the man at the right of the line, the other man with his hands behind his back, did a stupid thing. He swung his right hand round and fired a shot from the big pistol he was holding. But he didn't take time to aim properly, and the bullet went over Lee's head. The crowd behind screamed and scattered, but Lee had fired before the first cry arose, and his bullet caught the man's hip and spun him round so that he fell right at the edge of the quay, and then, unable to hold himself safe, he fell into the water, taking the gun with him. His cry was caught short by the splash. Lee said to the other men,
"Now he's going to drown unless you pull him out. You don't want that on your conscience. Hurry up and do that, and get out of our way."
He strode forward. The other men fell aside sullenly, and two of them slouched to the help of the man in the water, who was now splashing and shouting with pain and fear.
"Let me see that pistol, Captain,"
said Lee, and the captain handed it to him. It was a cheap and flimsy piece, and the barrel had bent when the boy dropped it. Anyone who fired it would be in danger of losing his hand. Lee tossed it into the water with regret, because he knew, in the moment he squeezed the trigger of his own revolver, that the cylinder had stuck for good. That was the one shot he was going to get.
"I'm going to need that rifle of yours real soon, Captain."
He put his gun back in the holster and looked around. The crowd behind was much bigger now, and the sounds had changed. Across the water, the steam crane was still, the operator and the ship's crew staring across at the place where the shots had come from. In the absence of the clank and crash of the great bucket, Lee could hear the steady chugging of the dredger near the harbour mouth and the excited murmur of the crowd behind. The three of them moved on. They were not far from the schooner now, and Lee could see the crew gathered on the poop, watching wide-eyed as the little group made its way along the quay towards them. But then one of them pointed at something back in the town, and the others shaded their eyes to look, and Hester said,
"Lee, you better look and see what's coming."
By this time they were level with the stern of the ship, and opposite the last warehouse. A little alley ran between that and the one before it. Lee looked down the alley, looked up at the two rows of windows in the warehouse façade, looked across the harbour at the steam crane and the coal tanker, checking everything before looking back where Hester was indicating, and he noticed the bear doing the same.
"What the hell is that?"
said the captain. A large machine, powered by some kind of gas engine, was making its way along the waterfront and turning onto the quay. In the moment or two Lee saw it in profile, he remembered the model he'd seen the night before in the parlour behind the stage at the town hall, the model of the gas gun the Larsen Manganese people had been showing off. It was monstrous. The steel wheels and the half-track behind were grinding their way along the flagstones, and the crowd shrank back against the harbour master's office wall to make room for it.
"A gun,"
said Yorick Birnison.
"Yep, I do this."
And the bear turned and ran silently into the alley.
"Captain, the rifle, if you please. Right now."
"Oh, yeah, yeah. Mr. Mate!"
the captain bellowed, and a voice from the rail called,
"Aye, skipper!"
"Mr. Johnson, would you go and bring my rifle and the box of ammunition from the lazarette, if you please? Look lively!"
Further down the quay, the gun had stopped. The crowd was backing away to give it room. A man in maroon stood beside it and shouted something through a megaphone which was utterly incomprehensible. Lee spread his hands wide. The man shouted again, and again it was impossible to understand him. Lee shook his head. Someone ran down the gangplank behind him and hurried up to the captain. A moment later, Van Breda handed the rifle to Lee.
Oh, thank you, Captain.
Well, my sweet Aunt Betsy. A Winchester. How about that?
You know this rifle?
Best there is. And in good order, too.
He swiftly filled the magazine, cursing his carelessness over the pistol, and enjoying the feel of a well-balanced and well-oiled piece of machinery. He felt much better having it in his hands.
Captain, this is the warehouse. This one right here.
It is.
Do you know exactly where your cargo is stowed?
Yes. All we need to do is open the door.
Lee took a handful of cartridges from the box and dropped them into his pocket, then turned to look back along the quay. For the gas gun had resumed its grinding forward movement, and Lee could see now how it was crude. It looked like one man to drive it, two to fire and reload. The long barrel rose and swung from left to right and back again, before settling on the stern of the schooner. It was a thing to smash down buildings with, a thing to sink a ship, and Lee thought that if they fired it just once, it would be the end of this adventure, and the end of him, too. It came closer, and Lee lifted the rifle to his shoulder. It was nearly at the end of the middle warehouse, just opposite the alley between that and the next to last, and Lee's finger tightened on the trigger. But before anything else happened, there came a thunder of feet and a roar such as Lee had never heard, and out of the alley burst Yorick Birnison, to hurl the huge weight of himself against the bulk of the gun. Lee gave a cry of surprise. He couldn't help it. The gunners cried out in alarm as the wheels and the track skidded and scraped on the stone. Yorick's first smash had swung the front of the gun round so that the barrel was pointing out over the harbour, and the driver desperately hauled at the brake. But then Yorick set his shoulder to the side of the carriage and heaved and shoved until the two front wheels had rolled over the edge and the whole gun tilted forwards. The gunners were shouting with alarm and struggling to swing the barrel back round, and then Yorick shoved again and the gun went off with a flash of fire and smoke and a deafening bang, sending a shell skipping across the water right into the side of the quay beside the coal tanker. It exploded with a plume of water, and rock hurled high into the air, scattering the ship's crew and the crane driver. But few noticed them, because the blast of the gun had infuriated Yorick, and now he had his claws under the rear of the carriage, and while the engine roared and the caterpillar tracks screamed on the stone, the bear straightened his back with an immense effort and heaved the whole weapon and its three-man crew into the water with a huge splash. One of the men jumped clear. The other two disappeared with the gun. Cheers from the ship's crew. A yell of delight from Lee. The bear dropped to all fours again and sauntered along to join Lee at the schooner.
Well, I'd hate to see you get angry, Yorick Birnison,
said Lee. Across the water, the crew of the coal tanker were cautiously inspecting the damage to the wharf. The crane driver was shaking his head at the bosun, who was yelling at him to get back to work, and the driver in charge of the rail trucks was running back from the engine to see what had happened. Even the dredger had stopped work for a minute, but presently the steady chugging resumed. For the moment, no one was moving among the crowd further down the quay. Lee looked around more carefully. To his right, as he faced towards the town, loomed the bulk of the warehouse, a three-story building in grey stone, with a row of windows on the top and middle floors. The massive doors were of steel and opened inwards. Projecting from the centre of the wall above the top floor, just under the eaves, was a beam and tackle for lifting goods directly up. The sun was bright now, for the clouds had blown away, and it shone full on the warehouse front from over Lee's left shoulder when he faced down the quay. Behind him, the captain was shouting orders, and Lee heard a muffled bang from below decks, followed by a coughing throb, which told of the detonator starting the heavy oil engine. On the foredeck, two sailors were busily removing the cover from the forward hatch, while another man was checking the tackle on a derrick that had been rigged over it on the foremast. Suddenly Hester said,
"Top floor right, Lee!"
He swung the rifle up towards the warehouse and saw what she'd seen, a flicker of movement behind the third window in from the end. He kept the rifle trained directly on it, but saw no more movement. Yorick Birnison stood beside Lee, glaring down the length of the quay towards the crowd. The captain and the mate came down to join them.
"Now, Mr. Mate, how are you going to move that cargo of yours?"
"It's on trucks. We set it all up ready before they locked us out. It won't take half an hour."
"Right. Captain, tell me this.
What's the layout in the warehouse? What do we see when we open the door?
The space is fully open. There are columns, I don't know how many, stone columns, supporting the floors above. On the ground floor at present, there are mostly bundles of furs and skins. My cargo is near the far wall on the left-hand side, stacked ready on trucks.
These bundles of skins, how high are they stacked? Can I look right across the whole space in there, or are they too high to see over?
Oh, too high, I think.
And what about stairs?
In the center, at the back.
And the upper floors?
I don't know what...
Lee, top left!
Said Hester, and in the same moment Lee caught a flash of sunlight as a window opened. He swung the rifle up, and that must have put the sharpshooter off, because the one snatched pistol shot went past him and thudded into the deck of the schooner. Lee fired back at once. The window shattered, scattering broken glass down three floors to the ground, but there was no sign of the gunman. Yorick Bernison looked up briefly and then said,
I opened the door.
Lee half expected to see him charge and flatten it in one rush, but the bear's behavior was quite different. He touched the steel door several times in different places with a claw, tapping, pressing, touching with the utmost delicacy. He seemed to be listening to the sound it made or feeling for some quality in the resistance it offered. Lee and Hester were standing back from the building at the edge of the quay, from which point he could see all the windows.
Lee, if that's McConville in there...
Ain't no if, Hester. I've known he was in there from the first.
Mr. Scaresby,
said the bear,
shoot a bullet at this spot.
He scratched an X at a point near the upper hinge of the right-hand door. Lee looked up to make sure the gunman at the window was still out of sight, checked back along the quay to see the crowd hanging back still, unwilling to come closer just yet, checked with the captain that the men were ready.
Right. Now this is what we'll do. Yorick Bernison and I will open the door, and I'll go in first. There's a gunman in there, maybe more than one, and I want to make sure they're not intending any unpleasantness. If you take my advice, Mr. Mate, you and your crew will wait on board and out of sight till you hear from me or Yorick Bernison that the place is safe.
You expecting more trouble?
Oh, I always expect trouble. Yorick Bernison, you ready?
Ready.
Here goes.
He lifted the rifle, took aim at the X on the door, and fired. A neat hole appeared in the steel sheet, and that was all. But then Yorick Bernison reached out a paw and pushed gently, and the entire door fell inwards with a deafening crash. At once Lee leapt past Yorick and ran into the warehouse, making for the open staircase he could dimly see straight ahead. And at the same moment a shot blazed out from dead ahead, somewhere in the ranks and rows of stinking bundles. The bullet clipped the shoulder of Lee's coat, feeling like the clutch of a ghost. And then came a cry and a crash from the ship outside. Lee stopped and took cover behind a row of bales. Stupid to rush in like that, he thought. After the bright sun on the quayside, this was almost like night, and his opponent's eyes were already well adjusted.
Where is he?
Came the bear's voice from behind him.
He fired from dead ahead. But there's at least one other man upstairs. If you take this one, I'll go on up and deal with him.
As he said that, he heard another shot, and another, from above, and a cry of distress and alarm from the ship. Lee and Yorick ran at the same moment, Lee lightly for the stairs, with Hester bounding ahead, and Yorick slow and ponderous for the first two or three steps as he drove against the inertia of his great bulk. But once moving, he was unstoppable. Lee, halfway up the open iron staircase, saw bales of fur and skins hurled aside like thistledown, and then came two or three quick shots and a scream of fear suddenly cut short in a hideous grunt. More shots from high up. Lee leapt up to the next floor, which was largely empty, with just a few wooden cases resting on pallets near the back wall. But it was much lighter here, with sunlight pouring in through the long line of windows. And there was no one in sight. Lee doubled back and made for the next flight of stairs. He couldn't run silently on these bare floors, and he knew that the man up there would hear him coming and have plenty of time to line up a shot towards the top of the stairs. He stopped just below the level of the upper floor and raised his hat high on the rifle barrel, and at once a shot spun it round and round, a good shot, instant and accurate. But it told him where the man was shooting from, the far corner, on the right as you looked at the warehouse from the quay. Lee stopped and considered. What he didn't know was how clear the floor was, whether there were barrels or boxes for the other man to hide behind, or whether he would have a clear shot to the corner. Nor did he know whether McConville was alone, or whether he had an accomplice who could shoot Lee in the back from the other corner. After all, the window that had opened when Lee was outside was on the left. He looked at the staircase he was standing on. The steps were open ironwork about 10 feet wide, and they led up towards a landing at the back wall of the warehouse. His best chance was to take it at a run, hope to avoid any bullets, and shoot fast as soon as he could.
Lee,
whispered Hester.
Pick me up.
He bent to lift her. She wanted to listen, and the higher she was, the better. She sat tensely in his arms, flicking her ears, and then whispered,
There's two of them. One left, one right.
Just two?
There's something in the way. Maybe barrels. Use that smoke leaf tin.
He put her down and fished in his waistcoat pocket for the tin he kept his cigarillos in. He tipped the last three out and slipped the tin back, keeping the lid. He'd polished the inside to a bright gloss until it was almost as good as a mirror. The floor above was a foot or so over his head. Heavy pine boards with an iron flange at the edge and a guardrail around the opening for the stairs. Moving cautiously up to the next step and keeping his head low, Lee lifted the tin lid up very slowly close to the nearest stanchion of the rail and tilted it so he saw along the floor and towards the right-hand corner where the shot had come from. He could see no one, but that was because a row of heavy barrels stood in the way. Two rows, in fact, one stacked on top of the other, separated by the pallets the barrels were standing on. Lee knew well how small a movement would catch a watching eye, and taking infinite pains to move slowly, he turned the lid round to face the other corner. That side was empty, apart from some piece of machinery under a tarpaulin, and Lee could see the gunman clearly, standing behind it and looking over the top, with his rifle pointed just above where Lee was standing. It was not McConville. The stone columns holding up the roof, 16 of them, each about 2 feet in diameter, were equally spaced along the length of the room in two rows, one near the back wall and one near the front. And Lee calculated that if he could reach the column closest to the stairs on the gunman's side, he might be able to shelter behind it while dealing with him. But that still left McConville free to shoot him in the back. This was really a hopeless situation, and he shouldn't have got himself into it. In fact, it was like pretty well every other situation he'd ever been in. And I'm still here, he thought, and Hester twitched her ears. He slipped the smoke leaf lid back into his pocket. Then from down below there came the loud, scraping clang of the big steel door being hauled out of the way. And under cover of the noise, Lee took a good grip of the rifle and launched himself upwards as fast as he could, running at an angle to the top of the steps and left along the floor to the shelter of the nearest column. His ears were full of noise, shots from right and left, and the echoes from the bare stone walls. He reached the column and pressed himself behind it. It was the third column from the end on that side. The tarpaulin-covered machinery behind which the gunman was hiding was near the middle of the end wall, and it was a little less high than the head of a man, which meant the shooter had to crouch all the time. Not a comfortable position to hold for long. The best way to deal with him, if he'd been alone, would be to wait till he moved, as he'd have to eventually, and pick him off with one shot. But behind Lee, at the far end of the warehouse, McConville had a better place of concealment and a clear line of fire. If he'd just had a pistol, it wouldn't be so bad, but those sounded like rifle shots, and Lee, pressed against the column, felt as well as heard the bullets striking his narrow shelter. McConville wouldn't miss too many times with a rifle. The first volley of shots came to an end. Lee ran again, past the second column, onto the first, a little further from McConville, making it safer as the angle tightened, and closer to the other man whose shoulder, was it? Lee could see, imperfectly concealed. He raised the rifle. In the same moment, he pressed the trigger and McConville yelled,
Duck!
His bullet reached the man before the warning did, and there was a grunt, a thud as he dropped his weapon, then a long withdrawn breath, and then silence. Lee looked at the tarpaulin and calculated, 5 running steps away, from right to left across McConville's line of sight, in about a second and a half. It should be possible. And it was. McConville fired twice and missed, but Lee made it and found the other gunman sprawled on his back with his pistol too far away to reach and the eyes in his pale face burning. A pool of blood was spreading out around him like a great red wing unfurling. His cat demon crouched by his side, trembling.
You've done for me,
the gunman said in the voice of a ghost. Lee said,
Yep, you're bleeding a lot. Reckon I have. Is that McConville over there?
Morton. Ain't no McConville.
Wouldn't that be dandy? What's he carrying?
Go stick your head up your ass.
Oh, you're a nice man. Now hold your tongue.
Keeping low, he patted the man's chest and sides to make sure he wasn't carrying another weapon, and then, ignoring him, turned his attention to the other end of the warehouse. In one way, it didn't matter if he and McConville stood and hid from each other all day long. Captain Van Breda could load his cargo without being shot at and get away with it. But sooner or later, either Lee or McConville was going to have to move, and the first one to do so would probably die. Suddenly a fusillade of shots rang out, and bullets thudded into the walls behind Lee and the tarpaulin-covered machinery in front. Two or three struck the columns and whined off into the corners. And in the middle of the barrage, Lee, who was crouching low behind the machinery, suddenly found himself knocked to the floor and dizzy with shock. Had he taken a bullet? Was he hurt? It was the strangest sensation, and then with a horrible lurch of nausea, he saw his Hester in the grasp of the fallen gunman's good hand. He had her around the throat. Lee was choking with her, but the outrage, a stranger's hand on his demon, was worse. He dragged his rifle round till the barrel was hard against the man's side and shot him dead. Hester leaped away and into Lee's arms, and he'd never felt her tremble so violently.
All right, gal. It's over.
It ain't. There's still McConville.
Think I'd forgot that, you dumb rabbit? Get a hold of yourself.
He rubbed her ears with his thumb and put her down gently. Then he looked out again, very cautiously, along the line of columns to the stack of barrels at the other end of the empty floor. There was no movement. But Lee realized with a little flicker of hope that McConville wasn't only brutal. He was stupid, too. A clever man would have done nothing, held his fire, kept as still as a stone until Lee had either killed or been killed by the other man. If Lee came out on top, he might have thought all the danger was gone, and McConville could pick him off when his back was turned. Instead of that, what did the fool do but give himself away? So there might be a chance. Those columns. Two rows of eight, equally spaced along the length of the building, back and front. When Lee looked past the left side of the row at the front, by the windows, he could see the whole room almost, clear across the centre of the big floor to the stack of barrels. But when he looked past the right side of the columns, he could see nothing but the narrow passage between the front wall and the row of overlapping columns, right down to the side wall at the far end. But that meant in turn that McConville would have the same view. If Lee moved along between the row of columns and the front wall, he'd be invisible to the other man for some of the way, at least. It was the best chance he had. He looked down at Hester and she flicked her ears. Ready. Lee quickly filled the magazine with the Winchester, and what a sweet weapon this was, and set off, making as little noise as leather-shod feet could on a wooden floor. For the first three or four columns he was safely invisible, and he was ready to snap a shot as soon as anything moved into sight at the other end. The further he got, though, the more dangerous, because as the angle increased, so did the gaps between the columns. Couldn't be helped. Take the rest at a run. He stopped at the last point where he was still fully concealed, opposite the big doors right in the centre that opened for goods to come up by the hoist, and then gripped the rifle and ran. And in the same moment he thought,
"My shadow. Damn. He can see my shadow."
The sun was pouring in through the windows. McConville had been able to follow his progress every step of the way, and no sooner had Lee realized that than two shots rang out, and he dropped. He was hit, but he had no idea where. He'd sprawled in the space between the second and third columns. With all his might, he dragged himself up and flung himself forward towards the rack of barrels. If he was close against it on this side, McConville wouldn't be able to see him. Maybe. He made it and slipped down to the floor. Hester was close by, trembling. Lee brought his finger to his lips, and he could do that because his hand was free. And his hand was free because he'd dropped the rifle. It lay out in the open, several feet away, and unreachable. He sat there with his back to the lower rack of barrels, smelling the stinking fish oil, feeling his blood race, listening to every drip and creak and scrape and click, and holding back the pain that was prowling around just waiting to pounce. It was his left shoulder, as he discovered a few moments later. Where exactly, he didn't know, because the pain inconsiderately took up residence like a bully and demanded all the feeling there was. But Lee tried to move his left hand and arm and found them still working, though badly weakened, so he guessed McConville's bullet hadn't found a bone. Damn, there was blood all over the place. Where the hell was that coming from? Was he hit somewhere else as well? He shook his head to clear it, and drops of blood flew off and splashed across his face. Simultaneously, his left ear felt as if a tiger had taken a bite out of it, and Lee had to hold his breath to avoid gasping. Well, ears did bleed, no doubt about it, and if it was no worse than that, then it was better than it might have been. Silence in the warehouse, apart from the drip of blood under the floor. Outside, the distant sounds of work and the cry of seagulls. Lee sat, stiffening with pain, with one gun that didn't work and yards from another that did, in the deepening stench of fish oil. Somebody's bullet, probably his, had punctured one of the barrels, and not far away from where he'd fallen, a steady trickle of the stuff was leaking down from the top rack and spreading slowly across the floor. In another 5 minutes, he'd be sitting right in it. Hester sat crouched tightly against his side. She was hurt by his wounds, but she wouldn't complain.
"Scoresby," came a voice from the other side of the rack of barrels.
Lee said nothing.
"I know you're there, you cheap son of a bitch. And I know I got you. Course, I don't know if you're dead yet, but you will be soon, you bastard. You think I didn't know who you were soon's I saw you? Ain't nobody I forget once I seen him. You was next on my list back there in the Dakota country. You better believe it. You should have seen them two marshals when I finished with them. Hoo-hoo, man! One of them had a serpent demon, and he took his eyes off me, and I picked her up by the tail and cracked her like a goddamn whip. You ain't never seen a man so surprised to be dead. That was by the Cheyenne River, and it left the other man on his own against Pierre McConville. That ain't good odds, Scoresby. You think of that. I can stay awake longer than anyone. He tried to outwake me, but in the end he fell into the sweet arms of slumber. And the sucker thought he'd tied me safe, but ain't nothing can hold me down. I got a trick for that. I snuck out of my bonds, and I lashed that son of a whore's feet and hands together, and then I just picked up his demon and tied her to his horse and unhobbled the horse. Man, that was funny. He woke up, and he saw the terrible fix he was in. He kept saying, "Here, sunshine, good horse. Don't go away now. Come on, you dumb critter, please. Please now, don't move." As long as that horse didn't move too far, he could just about live. But if something was to startle her so she ran off, well, bang, that's it. Like a hand coming up inside your ribs and feeling your heart still beating, and pulling it till the strings and the veins all pop and it comes away in your hand. Man, you're dead then, all right. In the end, I took his gun and I fired it in the air, and off old Sunshine took like a cannonball. You ain't never heard a scream like that Marshall screamed. Well, I'm gonna do that to you, Scoresby. There's that big hoist outside the doors there with a rope on it. I'm gonna play a trick with that, you bet. I'm gonna play with you and that scrawny jackrabbit for a long time.
The pool of fish oil had spread. It was close enough now for Lee to reach out and touch it. And then he saw Hester look that way too, and then at him, and then at his pistol, and he knew at once what she meant. McConville was still talking, but Lee blanked out his voice and with infinite care reached for the pistol at his waist. Holding it on his lap, he touched a finger to the pool of oil and brought a drop to the pivot of the hammer and another to the trigger mechanism and another to the bearing of the cylinder. With his weakened left hand holding the barrel as firmly as he could, he turned the cylinder with his right, very slowly, and felt it loosen. He pulled back the hammer. It moved stiffly at first, and then freely. He made sure there was a cartridge in the chamber and sat with the pistol cocked, waiting for McConville's deep, grating voice to stop.
"Well, Scoresby, I'm gonna start killing you now. This is your end a-coming. It's gonna be a hard one, and a long one. I made that other marshal's end last a good half hour by his pretty watch, which I took. I think I might let you stick around a mite longer than that. Depends how much you scream.
Lee heard the sound of a man getting to his feet and coughing slightly as if to cover a grunt of pain. So he had been hit. And Hester pricked up her ears, tensing suddenly, as she and Lee heard another sound, the slither of a serpent body along a wooden floor, and the faint, dry clicking of a rattle. McConville's demon, impatient to get the torture started, was moving ahead of him. And then, not 6 feet away at the end of the rack of barrels, the snake head appeared, and Hester sprang and seized it. She gripped the demon just behind the head and bit down hard. Lee felt every quiver of her muscles and clenched his teeth in sympathy with hers. McConville uttered a great cry of rage and pain and fell to the floor behind the barrels. Unable to move, Lee watched the furious struggle between the lashing, coiling, whipping snake and the tense little form of Hester, her claws slipping as she scrabbled on the floor. There was nothing for her to get any purchase on, no good turf, no springy twigs of sage, nothing but smooth boards, and the little rabbit had only half the weight of the snake. And Lee could feel with his demon the furious power of the twisting, writhing form of McConville's as she flung herself left, right, left, trying to tear her neck out from between Hester's teeth.
"Keep going, gal,"
Lee whispered.
"Hold tight there, sweetheart."
And she dug in. She tightened her trembling jaw. She scrabbled and slipped, but she dug in again and tugged and dragged and hauled, and little by little pulled McConville's demon away from him. McConville's cries were hideous. He scrambled across the floor. Lee could hear his boots slipping, his fingernails scratching, and his grunts and roars echoed around the warehouse till the air was full of the noise. And then, helplessly, he stumbled around the end of the rack of barrels, and Lee shot him. McConville crashed backwards against the window and slid to the floor. In Hester's mouth, his demon sagged and loosened, but Hester kept on tugging, and it was easier now, and McConville sobbed,
"No! No! Don't do it! God damn bitch rabbit!"
His face was the color of dirty paper. His mouth was a sagging red hole, and his eyes were bulging.
"McConville, you shot Mike Martinez and Brodus Vincent from a hiding place. Like a coward. And then you made little Jimmy Partlett fight you because he didn't want you to think he was a coward. You're a dirty piece of work. And this is the end of you."
And he shot the man through the heart. His demon vanished, and Hester tumbled back towards Lee, who scooped her up and kissed her and held her close till she stopped trembling.
"You better move, Lee. You got about 10 seconds before you're sitting in a pool of fish oil."
"And now our troubles begin, Hester,"
Lee muttered, struggling to pull himself upright, and just in time, too. Gingerly he moved his left arm and found, at least, that he could. He put his pistol back in the holster and went to pick up the rifle. Then he looked out of the window and saw the ship's crew at work covering the forward hatch, so they must have loaded the cargo. But one man lay dead on the deck under a sheet of canvas, and nearby on the quay a crowd headed by Polyakov was being held at bay by Yorick Birnison, whose bulk stood foursquare on the flagstones confronting them. Polyakov was addressing the crowd. Lee could hear the muscular drone of his voice, but not the words. He was trying to get them to move forward and, well, attack the schooner, Lee supposed, but the bear would have stopped a madder, braver crowd than this. Lee could also hear the chug of the schooner's auxiliary engine and see the exhaust smoke puffing from the pipe amidships. She was nearly ready to leave. He made his way carefully down the stairs. On the ground floor he found a chaos of torn bundles of skins, broken spars and lengths of timber, and the great steel sheet of the door lying flat beside the entrance. He walked out into the sunlight and made his way to the bear's side.
"Well, Yorick Birnison, the trouble's gone from upstairs."
The bear's head swung round to look at him, the black eyes glinting under the great iron ridge. And then Lee's head swam, and he lost his balance for a moment, but the bear's head moved in a flash and seized his coat between his teeth and gently pulled him upright again. And then things became confusing. There was someone shouting from the crowd, or did it come from beyond them? Loud voices bellowing commands, anyway, and then the disciplined, quick tramp, tramp, tramp of running feet in heavy boots coming along the quay. Behind him, Lee heard a splash and then turned carefully to see the bear's helmeted head emerging from the water and moving swiftly away. But he had to turn around again because an angry voice was shouting,
"You! Drop your weapon! Drop it now!"
And he saw it came from the man in charge of the squad of running men in Larsen Manganese uniforms, who had arrived at the head of the crowd now and stood, rifles aimed, facing him like a firing squad. Polyakov was standing safely behind them, frowning his approval. Lee considered that he didn't feel inclined to drop that nice rifle, and he was about to say so when another layer of confusion was added to the mix. A different voice from behind him said,
"Mr. Lee Scoresby, you are under arrest."
Cautiously, in case he fell over, Lee turned once more. The man who'd spoken was one of three. Young, armed with a pistol, and then a different uniform.
"Who the hell are you?"
"Never mind him,"
yelled the Larsen Manganese leader.
"Do as I say."
"I am Lieutenant Haugland. We are from the Customs and Revenue Board, Mr. Scoresby,"
said the young man calmly.
"And I repeat, you are under arrest. Put down your rifle."
"Well, you see,"
said Lee,
"if I do that, the senator over there will suddenly regain his courage and order those marionettes of his to come and take over Captain Van Breda's ship. And after all, me and York Burnison went through to help him load his cargo. That seems kind of a pity. I don't know how to resolve this situation, Mr. Customs Officer."
"I will resolve it. Put your rifle down, please."
The young officer stepped past Lee and faced the line of riflemen without a tremor.
"You will all leave the harbor now and go about your lawful business,"
he said, loudly enough for everyone to hear.
"If there is one person left on this quayside by the time the customs house clock strikes 12, they will be arrested. All of you move."
The Larsen Manganese men looked uncertain, but Polyakov, still taking care to remain behind them, shouted,
"I protest! This is an outrage! I am the leader of a properly constituted political party, and this is a blatant attempt to deny my freedom of speech! You should be enforcing the law, not flouting it. That criminal Scoresby..."
"Mr. Scoresby is under arrest, and so will you be if you do not turn round and leave the harbor. You have 2 minutes."
Lieutenant Haugland's fox demon said something quietly to Hester. Polyakov drew himself up to his full height and gave in.
"Very well. Under strong protest, and cheated of the justice we have a right to expect and a duty to demand, we shall do as you say. But I give you notice that..."
"Less than 2 minutes,"
said Haugland.